Department of Agriculture and Heritage, and to a different sort of event. As you can see from the circle, this is really about a conversation. It's about a discussion, and I suppose the starting point is the research network Converting the Isles on conversion to Christianity in Ireland and Britain, and indeed wider insular world, which is based in the Department of Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic, and has been for some time. And we were delighted when Joe Robbins came to Cambridge to engage in discussion with him, and hence the idea for this evening's seminar and discussion was born. And it's a real pleasure for me to introduce Professor Joel Robbins to you, who's now been, I think, almost a year, or maybe not quite a year, it might feel a bit longer, but a long, long time in Cambridge at this stage. And as most of you will know, came to us from the University of California in San Diego. And you will also know that he's done a lot of his fieldwork in Papua New Guinea, and that fieldwork has to a large extent been focused on Christianity as an agent of cultural change, that his focus has been very much the kind of the social and political changes associated with Pentecostal and charismatic Christianities in particular. You will know his numerous publications. I suppose key in this regard is his the anthropology of Christianity, and of course your work as well in 2004, Becoming Sinners, on Christianity and Moral Torment in Papua New Guinea. Some of you will have had a chance to read the paper which will form the basis of this discussion, and I think what we were thinking is that you might just guide us through some of those ideas again and then open the floor to discussion. But this really is a discussion. Before we launch into that, say welcome to the Department of Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic. We hope you come, you know, very soon again, and thanks for agreeing to lead this event for us today.
Well, I'm grateful for the chance to speak to you today. I'd actually heard about the Converting the Isles project a year and a half ago in Finland, of all places, where somebody told me I might be interested, and anyway, it's taken me this long to catch up, but I'm grateful for the invitation, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. I thought what I would do is talk a little bit about the themes in the paper for about 20-25 minutes, and then we could open it up to discussion. Sometimes once I get going, I feel free to stop me if there's almost no time left for discussion. But let me start by saying that the anthropology of Christianity has developed over the last 15 years or so. That's not to say that no anthropologist ever studied a Christian group of people before that. Of course they had, although there were far fewer anthropological studies of Christian populations than you might expect. Social anthropology had been the discipline that was charged with studying the other, and nobody was less other than Christians. And so there were pretty high barriers against studying Christianity, but people who had wanted to work in parts of the world that where the majority of the population was Christian had done some studies of Christian groups, and some of them had even focused on their religion, but there were certainly far fewer of them than you would expect given the representation of Christians in the world's population. So there were some good studies of Christianity by anthropologists before the turn of the millennium, but what changed about 15 years ago, we can say roughly 2000, but you know these things are hard to date, was that people began to develop the idea that anthropologists who study Christianity ought to start talking to each other across regional barriers, across barriers in theoretical interests, and ought to form a community that looked at Christianity comparatively across the world and across time for those anthropologists who did historical work. And that was really very new, and that is the sense in which there really hadn't been an anthropology of Christianity until about 15 years ago. There had been an anthropology of Islam that was organized in this kind of cross-cultural and comparative way. There had been work on Buddhism that was organized that way, Hinduism, but not on Christianity, and that's what changed about 15 years ago. Since it began to change, the anthropology of Christianity has really taken off extremely rapidly. So now it's so large that it's actually very hard to stay on top of. There's a bibliographic website called AnthroCyBib, AnthroCyBib, that attempts to keep up with this. And it's a good resource if you find any of this interesting. They're constantly compiling abstracts of new publications, and they run book reviews and essays and things like that. But anyway, the literature is very, very large now. The paper I pre-circulated was an attempt to review some of the key themes from the first decade or so in the field, right before the point that it became perhaps almost unreviewable in its vastness. In the paper, for those of you who've read it will recognize, I also tried to integrate the themes that I talked about by looking at them all through the lens of an issue that people working in a lot of different places had turned up, which is a kind of instability and tension in Christian ways of handling the relationship between the transcendent and the mundane. And the argument has been that, in fact, different strands of Christianity approach this differentiation between the transcendent and the mundane in very, very different ways, and that that provides a good basis for comparison between different Christian groups. I enjoyed trying to work that out through the paper. In part, I chose to do it because the paper was written as a memorial lecture for Edvard Westermarck, who has the distinction of being claimed by no fewer than three fields, sociology, philosophy, and anthropology. And he had worked with this idea a little bit. So I put it very central in that paper. I'm very happy to talk about it in discussion. I think it's a fruitful line of thinking. But in my brief remarks here, I'm going to set it aside as a kind of integrating theme, and instead just talk through the key themes in the early anthropology of Christianity that I had talked about in the paper, those themes being change, language, and individualism. These are all three areas where by now there's massive amounts of work in anthropology on Christianity, and so I thought I'd introduce them to you, and I'm happy to fill in more as people would like. I'm also going to mention a few emerging themes at the end that I think look to become important in the future. So let me just make two more quick points before jumping in. One thing that distinguishes anthropological studies of any religion is that they tend to look at lived religion in the round, as it were, attending to religion's connections to all kinds of other areas of social life. This is really the great strength of the discipline. It comes out of our fieldwork method, and those of you who've had any contact with anthropology probably have a sense of what I'm talking about. In a short survey of topics like the one I'm about to present, it's very hard to convey this strength of the discipline. But it is a strength that's been there in the anthropology of Christianity just as fully as it has been in anthropological studies of other religious traditions. And as time allows, I'll give a few examples from my own work in Papua New Guinea that may give a hint of how complex and multi-leveled anthropological discussions of Christianity can be. But this kind of Cook's tour that I'm about to lead us through isn't really a substitute for encountering these kind of fuller studies on themes that might interest you. So that's the apology. The second point I'll make the final prefatory point is that a lot of the early work in the anthropology of Christianity focused on charismatic and Pentecostal Christianity, the kinds of Christianity where it's held that all believers have at least potential access to the gifts of the Holy Spirit that allow them to do things like heal and prophecy. Preach in divinely inspired ways. We could talk about, if people are interested, why that group was such an important early focus, and why even anthropologists who didn't focus on Pentecostals and Charismatics tended to focus on Protestant groups. But the fact is that studies of those kind of groups are vastly overrepresented at the moment in the literature. There's much less work on Catholic and Orthodox churches, although that's changing quite a bit at the moment. So my remarks and even these themes that I'm pulling out, you will recognize as particularly developed in certain strands of the Protestant tradition. I realize this could affect the usefulness of some of what I talk about for some people here. But if we recall that the whole point of the anthropology of Christianity is to be comparative, is to compare different kinds of Christianity across time and space, then I hope that this early kind of focus of the anthropology of Christianity might serve more as an invitation to join the conversation on comparative grounds than as something that would make people who don't study Pentecostals and Charismatics or Protestants even, then it would make you want to turn away from it. And again, in the paper you'll see I'm trying to integrate recent work from Catholic and studies of Catholics and Orthodox Christians. I won't, in trying to be brief today, I won't do that, but that's certainly where one place our conversation could go. Okay, here are three key themes then from the first generation of work in the anthropology of Christianity. And the first one has to do with Christianity and radical cultural religious change. The anthropologists of Christianity have argued that at least some kinds of Christianity promote radical cultural change. And this is crucial, that also sometimes they actually achieve it, that converts sometimes actually succeed in very much changing the society and the cultures in which they live. We could call this, mindful of the project title, one could think of this as the distinctive anthropology of Christianity contribution to the study of conversion. It's distinctive because it works against a whole range of theories of conversion that see it as merely a change, as merely in one way or another what we might call a surface kind of change. There are theories of conversion that see it largely simply as a change of social identification. I'm sure that you are all familiar with these kinds of theories that say, well, becoming a Christian is saying you're a Christian, taking on a new kind of identity, but maybe not changing a whole lot else about, if not yourself, at least not changing a whole lot about your society. There's also a whole range of theories that see Christian conversion as largely a pragmatic issue. Sometimes these are called sort of Rice Christian kinds of theories, that people convert to Christianity because people who are in one way or another more powerful than them are Christian. They'd like to benefit from some kind of clientelistic attachment to that power, and so they become Christian in order to get what they can from it. But again, the change doesn't go very deep. It certainly doesn't change their social organization or their culture very much. And then there's the whole range of theories that say, well, people do take on some aspects of Christianity. They may even look quite Christian, but actually this Christianity is something like a thin veneer over their enduring and much more important traditional beliefs. Maybe they change the names of a few gods, those kinds of things. But in reality, if you look carefully, and this became a spur to a great deal of interpretive work, if you look carefully, you can still find what people once were underneath the Christians they claim to become. All of these more common theories of conversion argue strongly that there's a cultural continuity that underlies religious change. And they find good support in an earlier anthropology, which was also very invested in the idea that cultures endure for a long time and are inherently hard to transform. So traditional anthropology is often a friend to those kinds of theories of conversion. It's against the background of all of these theories and anthropology's traditional commitment to the enduring quality of culture that the anthropology of Christianity has focused on the way Pentecostal and charismatic Christians in particular promote radical change and sometimes accomplish it. They promote it by stressing the expectation and the desirability of change. One of the very common small snippets of ethnography it's something that a Ghanaian Pentecostal told an anthropologist whose work you might be familiar with, Birgit Meyer, told her, well, what we have to do is make a complete break with our past. And that slogan has sort of become the byword of this whole emphasis on how Christianity stresses change, and in fact, as one recent paper argued, makes it a moral activity. It makes change not a failure to reproduce your culture, not an attack on your culture, but a kind of moral practice in itself. So it promotes it by so Christianity promotes radical change by defining it as good. It promotes it by providing rituals that mark change or that foster change. Certainly baptism is a kind of ritual of rupture from the culture that you come from. Christianity isn't something you can completely drift into sort of silently and without really announcing that you've done it. It promotes change ritually through all kinds of healing rituals, which if you look very carefully at their symbolism or even at just the straight discourses that surround them, have as a focus transforming your relations both with your relatives who aren't Christian and with the traditional spirits that you might have had relationships with. And then there are all kinds of practices that are very prevalent in the world today. They're quite new, maybe the last 30 years, of what's called spiritual warfare. I don't know if people have heard of it at all, which are very clearly these kind of rituals of breaking with the cult. They're attempts to clear whole areas of evil spirits through Christian ritual practice. And that's very sophisticated, very well up on GPS and those kind of things, ways of mapping where spirits are, figuring out where evil has been done in a local area, and then organizing concerted rituals to clear it out. Again, though, if you look at the thematics of all of these rituals, they're about change, they're about making breaks with the past. So I've said that Christianity valorizes change by defining it as good, by making it something like a moral practice, that it promotes change by providing rituals that bring it about. And most complexly, perhaps, and this might be useful to some people here, and there's been a very robust anthropological finding, often, particularly Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity at least, promote change by defining the world that you're changing from as real. They very often preserve the spiritual ideas that people come to Christianity with. They preserve what anthropologists have come to call sort of traditional spiritual ontologies. They simply change the value of those spirits. They now say all these spirits that you used to interact with, all these spirits that you thought provided you with things that were important to you, they're real and they're powerful, but they're also evil. And you need Christianity to help you manage them. One of the things that the anthropology of Christianity has done has argued strenuously that once people come to define their traditional spiritual worlds as evil, a real change in their culture has happened. These kind of situations can look very like they're more about continuity in complex ways. People are still talking a lot about traditional spirits. They're still interacting with them a lot, although always in hostile ways. But a lot of work in the anthropology of Christianity has been done to argue that, in fact, we should see that as a radical kind of change. Change doesn't always mean coming to disbelieve in the spiritual world you lived in before. It can also mean coming to reinterpret it and reevaluate it. So those are some of the ways in which anthropologists of Christianity have looked at the importance of radical change in Christianity. I should add that the other point that anthropologists of Christianity have made is that sometimes converts really do succeed in their efforts at change. And that's a slightly different point than saying they become very interested in change. Probably a lot of people here would like to change their world, but day after day, maybe it doesn't happen. Often, Christian converts do make real changes. Here I'll give you a quick example from my own field work. I work with the Yoruban of Papua New Guinea. They're a group of it's a language group of about 400 speakers in the central highlands of New Guinea. I can't tell you their whole story now. But they were never directly missionized. Baptist missionaries came to their area. They sent out, older people sent out younger people to go study at schools the missionaries had set up in the groups of the areas of groups that neighbored the Arab. And these young people came back and taught people a lot about Christianity, but nobody converted except those young people who had gone and lived with the mission. But then in 1977, a charismatic revival movement moved through Papua New Guinea, being carried from place to place to place by local people. It had started in New Zealand, in fact. It had been carried from place to place to place by local people. And when it reached Yoruban, within a matter of 6 or 7 months, everybody in the community had converted. And that's, again, I won't tell that whole story tonight. But what I do want to say is that traditionally, Yoruban culture, one of the key organizing ideas of Yoruban culture had been that men and women were completely different from one another. And in some ways, and this is quite common in New Guinea, They were thought to be pretty dangerous to each other if they didn't regulate their relationships in certain ways. So in Yeratmim, men all, in a village, villages would be shaped pretty much like this, with there's sort of a horseshoe. This would be gone. In the center of the village would be a men's house where all boys over about the age of 12 would live with all the adult men. And then along the periphery would be women's houses where women would live with young children. All throughout the jungle where they hunt and where they sometimes spend time, there would be two paths everywhere because men and women weren't supposed to walk on two paths. Men and women were not supposed to eat together. That was considered really, really dangerous. And in religious life, women had roles almost wholly as spectators. The core religious rituals of this community were a long series of what they call male initiation rituals. They were meant to turn boys into warriors, but they were also fertility rituals. So they were really central to the reproduction of the society in every way. They were supposed to be completely secret from women. That was the understanding. And women certainly didn't participate in them except that they would hear what would be going on in the men's house or they'd hear what was going on in the forest. They were meant to be very frightened about it. But the idea was at least that if women found out what was actually going on in the rituals, they'd have to be killed. That was the local ideology. So men and women were very, very separate in traditional Yeratmim culture. And in a sense, women were completely excluded from religious life, as we define it as the sort of major public rituals. There were certain things, certain kinds of religious practices, or what are sometimes called magical practices, that women would do in relation to pig rearing and gardening. Anyway, in the wake of this revival, the Yeratmim completely, within a couple of years, completely did away with the system of men's houses. Men began to sleep in the houses with their wives. You can't find a single path now that's demarcated as a man or woman's path. Men and women eat together all the time. And men and women go to church together. It is true that men sit on one side of the church, women sit on the other. Yeratmim think this is a canonical kind of Baptist way of going about things. I mentioned they don't have missionaries, so they're sort of aware that they've never had anybody come and check. But they claim that this is a completely Christian way of carrying on. But they do say that women should preach, women can lead prayers, and there are women deacons who hear. They've developed a very elaborate rite of confession, which is another story. Women can hear confession, particularly because some women don't like to confess to men. So in the space of 5 years or so, there was a complete... the only other thing I'll say is, traditionally, all kinds of things were divided in between being women's things and men's things. Arrows were men's things, women couldn't touch them. Certain kind of pots were women's things, men couldn't touch them. This is something that's just very familiar for people who have worked in highly gender-segregated societies. Gender was also a major way of dividing the world symbolically, that there were men's things and women's things. Now, 5 years afterwards, not only is all the institutional support for keeping men and women separate gone, but the cosmological idea that somehow the world is divided into male and female things is also completely gone. Yeratmim find themselves extremely inarticulate these days in talking about what gender differences are. They still, I should say, have a sense that men and women are different from each other, but they just can't say more than that about it, and they don't organize their life very extensively along those lines. Maybe I've said enough to make the case that that's a fairly radical change. The last piece I was going to add is if you ask them why they did all this, they say, well, the Holy Spirit comes to everybody. Everybody is the same in God's eyes. God doesn't favor men or women, and so we now realize that all of this was a mistake. So they rationalize this all in Christian terms, too, and see it as important in Christian terms. In fact, some of the drive to have women preach more than they do follows from their sense that they would be in a better position for the second coming if men and women were preaching kind of equally amounts. Okay, so that's the end of that first theme, and I've gone into that in a little more detail than I will the others, which has to do with Christianity and change, both the valorization of change, the provision of ritual means for change, and finally the actual accomplishment of change. A second theme that might be quite surprising, but has been very, very robust in the early anthropology of Christianity, has to do with language. And I'm going to do this a little bit quickly, just enough so that you can see if you're interested, we could talk more. One of the real theoretical developments in social anthropology in the last 15 or 20 years was the development of a notion that anthropologists call language ideology, which could also, if ideology has very strong Marxist connotations for you, that could lead you wrong in this case, and you might want to call it cultural models of language or something like that. But it's the recognition that different societies look at language very differently. They think it works in different ways, they think it can do different things, and they think it has different purposes. And those purposes can actually vary really radically across cultures. One of the main line of argument in this regard in the anthropology of Christianity has been that Protestantism in particular, and Pentecostal and Charismatic Christianity tend to inherit this, actually has a very distinctive language ideology. This is a language ideology that believes that what language exists to do is to allow people to convey, to communicate sincerely with other people. For me to be able to take what's in my head and somehow get it into your head. And that's what language is really there to do. Now, this may not look like a very strange language ideology to you, because I'm betting it's yours. It is the language ideology that really dominates academia. And if you look at early histories of science, like Steve Chapin's work, if you look at early histories even of market relations and the development of capitalism, they very much depend on this kind of notion of language. And the arguments have been historically that it developed out of Protestantism. When you begin to spread Christianity in the world to places that haven't previously been Christian, it bumps up against other language ideologies, which very, very often, so you get a sense of what other language ideologies could look like, think that what language is really for is being polite. You wouldn't think of using language to convey your sincere thoughts and feelings. You use language to show your understanding of your relation to other people. Probably won't take a lot of work to convince you that this is possible, I'm sure. There are also places where the main thing people want to do with language is speak in very artful ways. You may want to persuade people, but not by conveying who you really are, but by using language in such beautiful ways that you bring them in. Both of these models of language use are quite different than this Protestant language ideology that what you should do is speak sincerely. And many anthropologists at this point have looked at what happens when these two language ideologies clash. They've looked at the efforts people have made, and this goes back to the theme about change, to try to develop a notion of being able to speak sincerely, of being able to communicate that way. They look at what people do with areas of their life where they're not willing to do that and how they handle the tensions that arise. I'm not going to give you my rotten example of that because I've been going on and on already, but if people want more, this is something I can talk about. Just ask me. It's an easy button to push. but I want you to know that there's a tremendous amount of work on that, and it's now expanded to looking also at how people think that religious objects communicate, etc. There's a lot of interesting work about that. The last of the kind of traditional, the first generation themes I'll mention is that of individualism. This is actually a really controversial area. There's been this seminar on locating religion. Oh, I see a few faces I recognize. Anyway, we've been convulsed by that 3 out of 7 meetings or something. There's a lot of debate about this right now. But the basic idea is that in global terms, most places in the world, people don't think of people as apart from their relations. They don't tend to think of what we would call an autonomous individual. They tend to think of people as parts of families, as parts of communities, as parts of webs of relationships. that really define them. And they don't tend to find opportunities where it's of much interest to them to abstract people from that and see them on their own. The argument is that this is mostly a modern Western idea, and it's been powerfully argued that it really arose from Christian ideas about each person being responsible before God. They're responsible for their own self before God. They're responsible for their own salvation. And the argument has been that only after arising in Christianity did it develop as a foundation for secular institutions like the market. I just saw a new book, an advertisement for a new book that came out within the last month called The Rise of the Individual and the History of Liberalism or something like that. And from the table of contents, it looks like it's arguing this, so I'm looking forward to reading it. Anyway, some claim that Christianity then brought this idea of individualism into the life of converts. And like the idea of the sincere speaker, converts have really wrestled with how to adapt it. To use an example that is in my paper very briefly, but that I like a lot, so I will use it. Once in my fieldwork, I came across a man reading the parable of the 10 bridesmaids from Matthew 25, where there are 10 bridesmaids waiting for the bridegroom. Some of them have already gotten oil for their lamps in case they have to wait out the night. Five of them have, but five of them haven't. And then the lamps of the five who don't have any oil. You all know this one? Anyway, the five who don't have any oil say, hey, we're running out of oil. Can you lend us any? And the five who have the oil say, no, we can't lend you any. We only have enough for ourselves. You better go get some. And then while those five are off getting their oil, the bridegroom comes and they miss out, and they call the bridegroom and says, I don't recognize you, I don't know you in there. They're not saved, right? And he was reading this, and I asked him, this also gives you a sense of how sophisticated people's Christianity can be in places like New Guinea. I said to him, well, what's that about? He said, well, you know, what they're really saying there is you can't share a belief. My wife can't break off part of her belief and give it to me. Belief is a really big thing, he said, and everybody has to have their own. Now, he brought this up because he and his wife share everything. They garden together. They're always breaking off bits of food and giving it to each other. Their lives are completely tangled up in every other way, but not in terms of belief. So he makes a big deal out of this because it runs so counter to every other way he would have of thinking about the role of relationships in making a good life for people. Okay, so the emphasis in the anthropology of Christianity that has then been about how people who come to recognize this idea of individualism but have not traditionally lived with it try to integrate it into their lives or try to hold it in existence and develop a kind of Christianity that doesn't make it central. It's been very controversial because some people have argued that Christianity itself really isn't individualist at all. That if you look at particularly some passages of the Bible, or if you look at the practice of some Christians, you'll see that Christianity is actually all about sharing in relationships also. It's sharing things like faith and grace and the Holy Spirit, and that it's all about relational entanglements itself. And so they say Christianity really can't have anything to do with individualism because it just doesn't have any individualism in it. Or slightly in a middle ground, they say, well, Christianity has individualist ideas in it, but people often either resist these or reinterpret these or find ways to accommodate them by drawing on other parts of Christianity that promote relationships. For example, Pentecostal healers who claim to be filled with the Holy Spirit when they heal, that would be a very strong relationship with the Spirit that would allow them to do their work. This is a really unsettled area, but it's very interesting, and I'd be interested to know if it has any relevance to the kind of historical work people do here, if this is really a completely kind of contemporary or post-Reformation sort of problem. Very quickly, a few new themes that are just arising now. This is sort of a trailer for work. There was a long 8-day conference on the anthropology of Christianity last year, just about a year ago now, actually, and people were really playing with new ideas and things. And so these are things I know are coming along, but that have not been central yet. One is about Christian social organization. Oddly enough, anthropologists have kind of left that out. But what kind of social groups are churches? Are there really only three kinds of churches? You know, kind of Episcopal, Presbyterian, and Congregational. And if there are only three, why do only those three work? Or are there more? What about schism? Is that a characteristically Christian kind of social process? And how does it relate to this kind of emphasis on change, this willingness to always be criticizing the past? What do you do with denominationalism? What kind of social organization is that? I just recently read something by Jose Casanova, the really kind of brilliant sociologist of religion, saying, well, every religion in the world now is a denomination. He didn't say more than that, so I had to guess what he meant, but it sounded, that they all coexist in the same space. It was interesting. There's been a new emphasis on Christian ideas about space. I didn't tell you about this, but there was a lot of work done already on Christian notions of time, but there started to be interest in Christian notions of space. Both rural and urban kind of changes in Christianity, which had been ignored, but also how earthly space is thought of, how it's thought of in relationship to heavenly space, how different kinds of Christianity either foreground or background the importance of space. Oddly, gender was not central in the first wave of the anthropology of Christianity. Part of that may have to do with where anthropology was at when it happened. But it's a little bit strange because actually some of the work on most of the work on Pentecostalism, of which there wasn't a whole lot, that appeared in anthropology before the anthropology of Christianity developed, actually was focused on gender and the possibility that Pentecostalism, especially in Latin America, was used to reform men's roles and to sort of domesticate them. Anyway, there is bubbling up now a kind of late focus on gender, and both gender as it influences social roles, but also how gender figures in Christian cosmology and how that gets worked out in these kinds of situations anthropologists study. And then finally, there's been an interest in where the edges of Christianity might be for a comparative field like the anthropology of Christianity. There's a professor named Janet Hoskins who studies Cao Dai, which is a new Vietnamese religion developed in the last, I'm not sure exactly to be honest, 70, 80 years. And Jesus, well, first of all, Cao Dai is very deliberately organized along Episcopal lines, borrowed from the Catholic Church. They want to be organized just like the Catholic Church. And Jesus is also in the Cao Dai pantheon, but he is three levels below Buddha, Lao Tzu, and Confucius, so he's put in his place, although apparently one American temple has moved him up one step. But what do you do with that? Can you be, as Dan Hoskins put it, can you be Christian and not put the Christian divine figures at the top of your pantheon? What about secular Christians? You know, what about people who go on pilgrimages, who certainly celebrate Christmas and Easter, but don't see themselves as religious? What about humanists who define themselves often against Christianity? Where does the comparative project of the anthropology of Christianity lose any purchase? What do you not want to include? And I suppose historically that's an issue too. So I hope I've set up enough targets to shoot at or topics to discuss. I'm happy to go into more detail about anything. I'd love to hear more about your own work too, but maybe I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, because I think, you know, so much of, so many of the themes you raised do, I think, resonate very, very strongly with what we've been doing. I mean, starting in a way with how you finished with the whole notion of the edges of Christianity, which I think in a way also feeds into, you know, what we've been trying to do in kind of measuring change and, you know, when does a Christian really become a Christian? So in a way that's, the issue of the edge, as it were, comes in very much kind of there. So in a way it kind of brings us back full circle from kind of
the cultural change to those kind of boundaries. And I suppose, you know, particularly the kind of the language ideology, because, you know, we're looking at texts for the most part, and I suppose monuments, but the different kinds of languages that those those kinds of texts use. I mean, certainly verbal artistry is there. I mean, divine truth, politeness perhaps less, because they're, you know, you know, texts are very interested in kind of, you know, direct conversion, as it were. I mean, I'm interested in terms of kind of the individualism. I think that's the one that, you know, personally at least, I would in a way see perhaps more sidelined, because of course we're thinking always of an institutional religion, but I think even in the period that we're looking at, the individual comes much more to the fore, and, you know, we might talk about, you know, so I mean, I think, you know, historically we can certainly see that move from an institutional religion to an individual one, and we can see that in various ways. But anyhow, but I mean, by way of kind of summary, just to say that, you know, all of your key themes, I think, have, you know, key relevance for us, and indeed can kind of educate us in important ways. But if I just perhaps open the floor to discussion, and we just continue to talk, and I see lots of hands going up already. So feel free, Roy, and then Eric, and whoever else.
Right, well, thank you very much for that. I have a lot to say in response, but I'll try to temper myself. I'll start with something a little more facetious. You mentioned the cow dye, and I was reminded of an Italian tabloid ran a survey a few years ago. Who do you appeal to in a time of need when you're ill? And guess who came sixth?
Who?
Christ.
Christ. Oh, I see it.
There's a list of saints that.
Oh, I see it. Right. Point. Okay.
And I suppose this point is not that facetious, because it also touches on this dichotomy, the sort of real or imagined, between what is transcendental and what is mundane. The shifting boundaries between those that your article deals so much with. And one of the examples there is, of course, what do you do with, and you do mention that briefly, what do you do, for example, with a cult of ancestors? What do certain king groups, for which this cult is very important, what do they do with them? And there are different strategies of either incorporating that, rejecting that, or pronouncing that as evil, for example, as you said. But what you definitely see a lot of in the early medieval period is attempts to incorporate that into the general framework of belief.
Okay.
For example, as saints who found monasteries. So you venerate the founder who might have converted as they founded the monastery, the church, for example. And the church can be something that will just be set up as some kind of property strategy within the family. The very facile term that often, what we often as historians use in that respect, is syncretism.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more to it than that. But there are these very elaborate mechanisms that develop for incorporation. What I was doing as I was reading your text, but also as reading and listening to you now, is trying to think how, for one thing, the aspects that you examined and the discourse that you apply can be used by us to think about medieval evidence. And overall, I think that the main problem that we always have with anthropology, both anthropological theoretical discourse, but also the empirical studies that you do, is that we often look at very different things, because you do have the advantage of gauging existing societies, studying them up close with all the problems that entails. Yeah. We can't do that. We rely on representations of that in texts. We have rhetorically constructed images of those societies. Yeah. It's very difficult to penetrate. So what often then happens is that if we try and apply anthropology, is that we don't compare like with like, because we compare empirical evidence with expressions of ideology.
Interesting.
Which is something Dumont, that person wrote the book, The Essays on Literature.
Yeah.
So he seems to fall in that trap as well. He doesn't always distinguish ideology from practice. Yeah. Which is again also the difficulty of, for example, looking at the Bible as an expression of. Sort of received Christian doctrine, because of the Bible has only been influenced
by scripture.
So anyway, just to cut a long story short, I was, so I'm looking at these three aspects that you dealt with and how what might be, in terms of medieval evidence, what might we use to gauge these aspects? So, for example, you, I won't take them up in in your order, but I'll take them up in a different order. For example, sincere speech. So, is there an observable phenomenon that we can talk about in medieval times to dealing with sincere speech?
Yeah.
And the first thing that comes to mind is confession.
Okay.
Where at least again, ideologically, it is meant to be a sincere speech, but of course that becomes ritualized very quickly.
Yes.
And you know, people turn up with their checklists of sins that have corresponding checklists of penances, and one begins to match one to the other. So again, I'm mentioning this to again to emphasize the difficulty of examining these categories. Individualism again. If you look at the ideology and the ideological expressions of that, and an individual's responsibility for their own self. Of course, you can find a lot of textual references to that.
Yeah.
But then, especially when you look at rural societies, which in converting the Isle, these are the most societies that we are looking at. Unlike, for example, when you talk about conversion of the Abbasid caliphates, where you have towns and they're very robust and people move into them individually and convert and they find safety in numbers and all that. In the medieval West, you don't really find that. So communities still tend to be the basic building blocks of society. So I was again trying to think how an individual can nevertheless be engaged there. One of the ways, in the context of institutionalized Christianity, or in the church, like Moira mentioned, is property ownership.
Long-term,
you begin to see the church encouraging individuals to alienate property, then the individuals become more robust
in
an ecclesiastical context. And so this also ties into the question of change, which is the most difficult and one that we're constantly struggling with in this network. In terms of observable phenomena, it's again very very difficult to gauge, certainly at the level of the individual. What I tend to do more in my work is look at questions of how society, especially rural society, which remains largely unchanged, is then reinterpreted. So you keep what is existing, but you reinterpret it as something else.
Eric, and then I'm sure there will be others. I don't know if you want to come back, or if you want to hear some more thoughts and comments first.
Whatever.
Whatever works for you.
I'll pull out two things from there quickly, but there's lots more we could talk about.
The discussion doesn't need to.
Yeah, it doesn't always have to go. Okay.
But people can kind of come and go as they please, and we will also move the discussion upstairs at some point. But anyhow, let's from the mundane to the
the convivial. Just really quickly, I find the incorporation versus kind of rejection. That's really interesting, and one of the things it would be really interesting to try to figure out is where, is that a function of different kinds of Christianity? Is it a function of different time periods? It's, one of the things I know, and there are people here who will know this better than me, but I've picked it up anecdotally a lot. For instance, in China now, people are very worried about their children converting because that they feel that means they won't become ancestors. So there's a sense they have that at least Christianity now is not going to find an alternative way to incorporate them. But there must be places in the world where incorporation still goes on. I think that's really interesting, and I think it has been relatively neglected. This is just an anthropological way of reframing some things you said, but that are important. I think these two things link up, but if they don't, maybe they're both worth saying. One has to do with the kind of belief practice. One of the things Dumont says about that, just for what is, he says that itself is actually a culturally variable kind of idea. That we come from a culture that thinks that disjunctions between belief and practice are important and noteworthy and certainly need to be morally examined. There are other cultures where practice that falls short of belief doesn't invalidate belief. I mean, that culturally, the relationship between practice and belief itself is variable. But also, anthropologists also work a lot with rhetorical representations of society, but they do put them together in very, I mean, we both have ways, but they may be different, of sort of evaluating evidence and trying to work through them to get a picture. But of course, our contact with the people we don't contact the whole society. We're getting different people, different events, and their representations of things, and trying to develop an analysis out of that. But that goes all the way then to the last thing I want to pick up, which is that at least in some, and only in some, but they happen to be ones that I come from, branches of anthropology, if you're doing the same thing but reinterpreting it, then eventually it can't be the same thing anymore, even if it looks to the naked eye like the same thing. There are branches of anthropology that would not follow that, but that's been pretty important to the way I've wanted to look at it. But it's really, great. Thank you for those comments.
I mean, I think if I could add one thing about incorporation, because even I think in the time period we're looking at and across different regions, I think there are differences even there in how various kind of past traditions have been incorporated. And what's key is even incorporating within this kind of universal Christian framework, so bringing your past into this kind of Christian framework and reinterpreting it in that way. But there are even as I say, across the couple of hundred years we've been looking at,
there are real differences.
There are differences.
That is really what Christians do with their past in terms of how they curate them and what they really interesting.
Thank you. I'm interested, I guess as a medievalist, I'm thinking of this particularly with Catholicism in mind. But I suppose that as historians, maybe it's probably different for archaeologists, but as medieval historians, one of the main reasons for why we might find it attractive to think with anthropology when we approach our sources is precisely what you were saying at the beginning of the anthropological tradition of studying lived religion and religion as a part of social life. Mm-hmm. I think many of us might, in some ways, feel encumbered by a very different scholarly tradition, which is that of learned Latinate church ecclesiastical history, which is strongly theological and has a very well-defined and very powerful and large canon of writers going from Augustine by Aquinas. And I think a lot of us find that an interesting tradition to think about, but also one that, if we want to understand something about the reality of religious life, also has to escape. But I wonder how you, as an anthropologist, think about theology and think about the learned Christian tradition, because there are lots of anthropological concepts which have their theological equivalents. You talk about transcendence and the mundane, and we might talk about the sacred and the profane.
Yes.
You talk about ritual, and we might talk about liturgy.
I'm not the only anthropologist in the room, by the way. We have a whole, so people should feel free, because they work in different traditions, some the same, and so I shouldn't be the only voice on this, because I think this is a really interesting area, and it's one that I'm going to take your question in two senses. One thing I think we don't know very much about, and it's been very hard for us to learn about, and this is where you historians, I think, have a real advantage, is what the process is by which learned theological ideas get into people's lives, because clearly they do. And we haven't been able to study that very much because we just don't know very much theology. It hasn't been part of our education. I mean, we're trying, people are trying to learn now, but it certainly isn't part of your curriculum, and you've got a lot of other things to learn. And so the first thing I think, and there has just been a special issue of the Journal of the Australian Anthropological Association taking up some of these issues and things. I could send you the reference if you want it, but of trying to begin to look at, not just folk theology, which is a whole separate issue, what kind of theology you could extract from these sort of rhetorical presentations, but what the interplay is between sort of academic theology or high theology. So that's the first thing. That is something we could approach empirically that I think is really important, but I think historians can too. And I think, anyway, that's something I'm pretty excited about at the moment. There are two other debates that I won't... One of the streams that has come along with the anthropology of Christianity is an interrogation of the Christianity of anthropology and how many of our categories are Christian in what ways, and in what ways that impeded us for a long time from studying Christians. And Fenella Cannell, who a lot of people know, did a lot to work on that issue, exactly around issues of transcendence. But there's been a bunch of others, and I can point people to that. So the sort of the Christian understructure of anthropological concepts has been an issue that a lot of people have explored. And then some people have been interested in what the possibility for dialogue between anthropology and theology would be. And that's just kind of getting off the ground. So I guess actually that's three different ways. But I think you're hitting on a really interesting area, both empirically and as a sort of matter of what kind of, about relations between disciplines and the theoretical prospects of working across them. I don't know if that...
Yeah, absolutely. No, this issue was broached quite famously a few years ago by an early medieval historian.
Oh, really?
Book.
Oh, yeah, that book on ritual. Yeah, I know that.
Where he talked about the problems of using social science language and studying medieval religions, because a lot of the social science language comes from medieval religious concepts.
That's right.
It's very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, no, that's it. And Talal Asad is an anthropologist who's actually looked at medieval materials with similar ideas in mind. So, yeah, I think it's a very important and relatively unworked through set of issues. I don't know if people wanted to add anything.
Yeah, I wanted to add anything.
Yeah. I'll know I've loaded when you get up and leave in mass.
We're now the chance to ask questions of your colleague, or indeed anybody else have any?
Sorry, Julianne. I was really interested in using transcendence versus the mundane as a mechanism for comparison, and sort of touching on what Eric was saying. But I kept coming back to, with respect to how you applied it to characterizing Pentecostalism, that I couldn't escape from the fact that we're sort of ignoring the structural factors that would make Pentecostalism, you know, so unique. The reason why it is attracted so much attention is because it is such a rupture with the norms of social religion. And whether, I suppose I was teasing out whether the validity of using that mechanism to analyse it on some level ignores the structural facets of Pentecostalism not being an organised, institutionalised religion in the way that Catholicism or Protestantism is. But, does that... Where it led me to was trying to use the transcendental versus mundane as a mechanism to compare Protestantism and Catholicism, because when you come to Protestantism in the article, you sort of talk about the language of sincerity being you contrast language with ritual.
Right.
So I wasn't really feeling or wasn't really sensing how you might compare, how you might map the transcendental versus the mundane as experienced differently in Catholicism or Protestantism.
Yeah, okay. So I heard a couple of different questions there. There's a kind of standard way of doing that. A lot of people feel this is too pat, so I'll just say that off the bat, which is that, you know, if you're just going to put Catholicism and Protestantism next to each other, then Protestantism is a lot more invested in the sort of eminence of the divine, and Protestantism is a lot more interested in the distance of it. That's a very broad sweeping generalization, which is why I said, but if you're just going to put all of Catholicism up against all of Protestantism, that
that's a way that people tend to do it. And I certainly did some of that in the paper. And in some ways, like all those big sort of stereotypical distinctions, there's some truth to that. You then have to get down to cases. You have, there's a really interesting article by an anthropologist who sadly died shortly after publishing it, Clara Mafra, that's in the bibliography there, who said, well, we've got all these studies of Pentecostalism all over the place, and we have a lot from Brazil, because Brazil, you know, Pentecostalism has grown very rapidly in Brazil, but nobody's talking about what it matters that almost everybody who becomes Pentecostal in Brazil was Catholic first. They don't become charismatic Catholics necessarily, but they were. And she tries to tease out the investment in what she calls saintliness versus the investment in sincerity. Sincerity be something internal. And so those are the kind of ways you want to get at it in a close-brained way. I would say about Pentecostalism, and this kind of cycles back to what I heard in the first part of your question, that I don't think its relationship, the relationship it posits between the transcendent and the mundane, is unrelated to its relatively disorganized character. I think it's precisely because it allows the sacred to become eminent in all kinds of people, that it's very hard to contain in enduring institutional structures. I can claim that the Spirit's speaking to me, and I can go start my own church, and that gives it a lot of its kind of this. It's one of these words you read all the time and never say this. Gives it a lot of its sort of fragile structure. Yeah, I don't know if that's helpful, but I think that I will say that the transcendental and mundane thing, and this is the kind of thing it's hard to write, but easier to say in this kind of thing. Where I did field work, I was extremely struck by how concerned people were with the difference between a kind of perfect Christian world that they thought they might be able to live in heaven and the world they live in now. And nothing I had ever read about Papua New Guinea groups suggested that that kind of concern was ever there for any of the people other people were studying. And so then when I came across this axial age kind of broad distinction between societies that posit a big difference between the transcendent and the mundane, however they relate them, and those that don't, it made a certain kind of sense to me coming out of my fieldwork. A lot of anthropologists are suspicious of it, though, again, because it's so big and huge. But anyway, I hope that answers a couple of the questions. Thanks for that.
Yes, thank you very much. I should probably say, just for the benefit of everyone, I'm a bit of an interloper, so
okay.
Writing a piece of anthropology, but I'm based in the Faculty of Divinity. And my fieldwork has been living in Pentecostal holy camps in Nigeria, and I'm writing a piece on deliverance.
Oh, wow.
So deliverance I was really interested to read this thing about the transcendent and the mundane and the way that Pentecostals negotiate this, because the deliverance rituals that I look at, which are incredibly visceral and usually end up with people sort of vomiting all over my sandals, really are a very potent physical representation of this negotiation process. So without boring all the medievalists, I don't want to pass up this opportunity. I just wondered, on these links with these traditional epistemological precedents, Bigot Mayer uses the word bridge a lot. And I'm wondering whether, do you think anthropologists have really got it right in their explanations of rupture? And if not, where it should go, and how we can describe the sorts of things that I'm talking about or that I'm looking at as more than just a framework or witchcraft repackaged, or because I'm very uncomfortable with that, and yet I don't quite know how I would articulate what it really is. So I'm wondering about that. And then I have other questions, but maybe
well, that, I mean, that's a big question, and it's been at kind of the heart of this debate about change. I foreshadowed some of what I'd say. This is my point about how if people do things but represent them differently, they're going to be different things. My own efforts to think, you know, one of the things you have to do if you're going to try to say if things are staying the same or changing is decide what it is you're looking at. You know, one of the things that Christian deliverance rituals don't tend to do a lot of is change the way people breathe. I mean, you know, possessed people breathe differently, but I mean, they're just not that interested in that. So if you chose to look at how people breathe, it'd carry right on through. They're breathing the same way. Does that make? But often in I'm going to tell a story for the second time today and see if this helps you. If not, I mean, we could talk about it theoretically, but it would probably be too long an answer for everybody who wants to get upstairs already. 12 years ago? Who would know exactly? I was in Taiwan.
Longer than that.
I was in Taiwan. Longer than that. I'm getting older. And a master's student who belonged to a Pentecostal church was getting an MA in anthropology, very bright, gave me a piece to read by, I don't know if he is an anthropologist, Murray Rubenstein, I don't know. And he said, I want you to read this and then I want to meet with you. And so I read this piece. And it was a very good piece about the history of how Pentecostalism came to Taiwan. But one of its big claims was that one of the reasons that Pentecostalism caught on is that being filled with the Holy Spirit was a lot like traditional forms of spirit possession. I think that's how the argument went. And, okay. So I read it, and we got together for coffee, and he said, so what did you think of the article? And being the annoying anthropologist that I am, I said, oh, it was fine. What did you think? And he said, well, I think most of it's really good. You know, he has the history right. But this place where he says that getting possessed by the Holy Spirit is just the same as traditional possession, that's completely wrong, because the Holy Spirit isn't one of our traditional spirits, and that makes it completely different. So that would be, for me, that's an important clue that at least they think something's different. And part of the emphasis in anthropology has been on, are we or are we not going to take seriously people's statements to be doing something different? In a broader theoretical terms, I could send you something about this or whatever, I think you have to look at what people's projects are when they do things like get delivered. Are they trying to be saved? Are they trying to reach more traditional goals? What's the sort of ultimate telos of the activity that they're engaged in? For me, it's when that's changed that I'm ready to say that things have really significantly changed and that whatever is left the same is a little bit like the breathing thing, kind of accidental or not what you'd want to focus on. One of the things that's happened in this individualism debate is I have argued pretty strongly along these lines that if what people ultimately want is salvation and they think they get that as individuals, then that means all these relationships they have along the way ultimately have a different value. Richard Werbner, who's been a real strongly arguing the other side, said, well, actually, I should tell you, the Christians that I work with in Botswana, they don't really care about salvation. So he's undone, and that's fair. I mean, but that's, then maybe it really is something different than what I'm thinking about, because the ends that people are aiming at are different. But those are some hints of ways I would want to try to unpack that.
Just a brief interjection. One of the speakers we had in our previous conference, Thomas Dronen, mentioned epistemological attitudes to conversion. He works on, one of the things he works on is applying the theory of incommensurability to the idea of conversion. He's written quite a lot about that.
Oh, really? Oh, I should get those references. That would
Thomas
be...
Dronen.
Yeah, Thomas?
Dronen, D-R-O-N-E-N.
Okay.
I have a question about what you mentioned about language ideology. And I was wondering
how that might affect what they're writing and how they think and how they interact with their religion?
Oh, that's a terrific question. One of the real architects of language ideology is a person named Catherine Woolard, who's also a student of bilingualism. I could tell you how to get in touch with her. And she could, there's been a lot of, so the first thing to say is I don't know is certainly code switching, switching between languages is always ideologized. That itself is ideologized, what it means to switch. It's always meaningful because it's always ideologized. Whether there's been any work on whether people are running two language ideologies concurrently, that's fascinating. I'm sure there has to be, but I don't know it off the top of my head. I mean, when you think about register, which is, we're talking in a certain register here. It's very recognizable. So if I started to swear, you'd know we switch registers. You know what I mean by swearing? Yeah, or whatever. We have, in effect, we all have different sub-languages that we use that mark what situation we think we're in, what relationship we think we have to the person we're trying to, all those things. I'm also thinking there's probably, and register has been a really focus of a lot of work recently, I'm betting that if there's nothing on different language ideologies for that, there's definitely different language ideologies that go with different registers. So that's really interesting. There is a very nice article about about how Kekchi, I'm going to have to recall the whole argument and give it to you, but it's about language and gesture in two Mayan communities, one that primarily uses Spanish and the other that primarily uses Kekchi. Charismatics are known for having a much bigger gestural. Anybody who knows, is this true? People say it. I can tell you about how high you lift your arms, exactly where you, what part of the evangelical spectrum you come from, but that was actually correlating really interestingly with different languages. And
I'm conscious that Jill has been talking for an awful long time, but I'm also conscious that this discussion, should and will continue, but you might, what our plan was to move two floors up to the common room of the Department of Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic, if somebody could let us in, because I stupidly now remember I left my card inside. And that we'll have some wine and soft drinks there. So we could, move up there and kind of, as I say, I would hope that we would continue the discussion there. At some point then, for anybody who's interested, we will all just go and eat together. So again, if you want to have some drinks and stay and join us when we go out to dinner, that would be absolutely fine. But I'm conscious as well of your throat.
How does it sound that bad? I have a little cold, but it doesn't hurt.
I don't want to engage in a kind of a ritual of rupture here or anything, because I really do want it more to be kind of a continuum interchange, but I think we could perhaps just move into a different kind of, language ideology, maybe a different kind of mode. But I suppose not before kind of thanking you for the first time kind of here formally for, really educating us in, I think, very basic ways. But I think one of the things that's kind of become clear is that we are talking about the same things. It's just sometimes, I think, difficult for us to recognize that because of the different kind of, academic terminologies that have kind of grown up around, the kinds of things. So I suppose, that is, an invitation to all of us just to continue talking and to kind of get to know each other's kind of languages and language ideologies better. But thank you very much for showing us how, and let's continue, as I say, upstairs. So two floors up, just follow the locals and give us a minute to get some bottles out.